Okay, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome again. Good news, the microphone is working today. It seems to be a random variable as to whether it works or not, so it strikes me that maybe the summing for the learning theory thread of this course, you could estimate the probability of it working and when. So there's a bit of practical application for you. So I assume that some students are so eager to start innovative learning that they've begun today. But nice of you to turn up, those of you who have. We'll try and make the lecture fun, but also informative, let's hope. So today we're going to look at, take a closer look at sorting. Now, I hope it's fairly obvious that sorting your data is a very important thing that one can do. Once your data is sorted, you can deal with it much more efficiently and much more effectively. So it's worth having optimal sorting algorithms. And in fact, there are many, many different kinds of sorting algorithms to suit various different conditions. What does optimal mean? Well, you'd like to do it, obviously, as fast as possible. What's the fastest you could possibly sort n items of data? Well, in one of the tutorial exercise sheets, you'll see that under a reasonable model, that's to say, if you assume that all you know about your items of data is how you can compare two of them and decide which is bigger, so if that's all you know about your data, then you can't sort your data faster than in time n log n, proportional to n log n. And the proof of that is surprisingly easy. Now, notice how big a statement that is. That says, of all the infinitely many sorting algorithms there are, none of them can run faster than n log n time. It's not a statement about any one algorithm, it's a statement about all algorithms. And yet, it's surprisingly easy to prove that statement. So I expect you're now very excited to go and look up that tutorial sheet. But don't do it just now, because we have to look at this example here. Okay. All right. So we're going to look at, and also then we're going to look at a kind of general paradigm for algorithm design that is often effective. Not always, but often. Okay. All right. So the sorting problem. Very, very obvious, but let's just state it in the way we're going to approach it. So here we're given an item, an RAA of items with whose order can be compared. So we have a known order on the keys of these items, and we can compare any two keys and say this one is bigger than that, this one is less than that, or they are equal. Okay. We might as well think of the RAA as consisting of integers, to be honest, because all that matters is the ordering. Okay. But the items could be of any kind on which you have a total order. Okay. But just for simplicity, I use examples with integers. It saves having to explain the order. Okay. That's the only thing that we have going for it. Okay. So the task is to sort the array by increasing keys. That's to say, the item in the first position is no bigger than anything else, and the item in the second position no bigger than anything else after that, and so on. Okay. So, obviously. The number of items we'll denote by n, just to save us having to redefine this every time. So n is the number of items you've got to sort for the rest of this talk, okay? All right, what's important for a sorting algorithm? Well, apart from, let's not say correctness. Correctness is always important, right? So we should never have to say it's important, it's correct. Well, if it's not correct, it's of no interest, whatever, right? Over and above correctness, what else is important? Well, the worst case running time is going to be of interest to us, obviously. another interesting feature is whether the algorithm runs in place or not. By in place, we mean that apart from your given data, the array of your data, you only use order one extra storage space. Okay. So that means you use a few variables of non-compound data items, storing a few integers or whatever. Okay. That's in place. If you have to declare yourself another array of size n, that would not be in place because now you're using order n, theta n extra space. Is that fairly clear to everybody? So that's what's meant by in place. Okay, so you can't insist you don't use any extra space at all because then how would you do any control variables? But, apart from those, you don't use any extra space. Obviously, if you have an algorithm which is both efficient and in place, that's quite a desirable property. Okay. You're saving storage space. Okay. The third feature, we shan't actually do much with it ourselves. I just mentioned it because in some other applications which you might come across in future years, it might be important there. So I'll just introduce it to you, but we shan't do a lot with it, okay? So don't get too concerned over it. But do understand the definition. So to say it's stable is to say this. We're given our data in the array, okay? You're going to sort, so that's going to mean moving it about. But suppose you've got within your array, you've got an item here, an item here, and let's say an item here, all of which happen to have equal keys, say K. Okay? Yeah? Now, when you sort this, they might move about, but the idea is that the relative order of these is maintained. So when you sort them, you don't swap these two around. You just put them one after the other. Is that a clear idea? Yeah? So that can be important for some applications. Okay? So that's another way in which we can quantify or qualify an algorithm. Yes? Not off the top of my head, actually, yet, because I've never used it myself. I think if you imagine that this has other items of data in there and you've got some indexing into them, maybe. Okay, but I'll have to look up some. Okay. Yes, I forgot to check that, I must admit. But good question. Exercise for your Innovative Learning Week. Find an application where this is important. I have to admit, I've never used it myself. So, you know, it's one of those things that I... But let's not get hung up on it because... thank you for asking. I will now have to go and look something up. But you should do that too. Okay. Now, first of all, we of course know sorting algorithms of various kinds. We've already looked at insertion sorting. I discussed it in detail at an earlier lecture, so I won't do this in detail. So this is just to remind you. Okay, it's a very obvious sorting algorithm. It's probably the first sorting algorithm one would think of. That's at least not too bad, but it's not terribly good either because its runtime is proportional to n squared. Okay, n being the number of items, and we saw that earlier, so I won't go through the details just now. Okay, it is both stable and in place. Okay, if you just go through the details, you only need just a few extra variables. That's obvious from the pseudocode. The fact that it's stable, you can just see by following the pseudocode, and you see that if two items have equal keys, they won't be swapped around. They just be maintained one after the other. Okay, so that's okay, but can we do better, than n squared? Remember, if n is in the order of millions or billions, n squared is significantly much bigger. Okay, so we can't expect to do better than theta n time, of course, because we've got to at least look at every item. Okay, obviously. By the way, challenge: prove that formally. Okay, prove it formally. Right, that's a little bit more challenging. It's intuitively obvious, but prove it. Okay, how do you start to prove such a statement? Remind me at the next lecture I give to explain how you would prove it formally, okay? It would take about the famous 30 seconds, okay? All right, let's see how we might do better. Well, we can do better by making a simple observation, okay? Suppose we've got our array, and the lower half is sorted, and the upper half is sorted. Let's just suppose that's the case for some reason or other. How much would it cost us to sort the entire array? So imagine this room of people, okay? This half of you came in order of height. This half of you came in order of height because you're that kind of body of students, Yeah? How could I get you to be completely in order of height? Well, one group stands there in order, the other group stands there in order, and I look at the two from each group and pick the one of lower height, and they go at the front of the queue. I look at any remaining, pick the one of lower height, etc. Yeah, keep going. Okay. If one of the groups is finished by this process, then any remaining people just go in there, give an order. How much has this cost me? Well, I compared once, and you went into the queue. Compared once, you go into the queue. Compare again, yeah? So there are n in total, and I do one comparison at most for each putting into the queue. So I'm done, I'm doing basically theta n amount of work to get the whole group of you properly sorted, yeah? Okay? So if it so happens that the lower half and the upper half are already sorted, we can complete the job in just theta n time, okay? Which is pretty good, because you can't do any better than that, okay? But a slight problem, what if you were not, if you were an uncooperative group of students and didn't come in half-sorted, half-sorted? You know, you just want to cause problems for me. I know you don't want to. I know you're very nice people, so you're not going to do that, but just as a challenge, you know, innovative challenge. Well, if you were sorted, I know how to do it, half and half. So my challenge is to sort each half of you. Well, I know a way to do it. Just apply the same idea to each separate half of the room. Okay? And now, recursively apply that, applied. Okay? When do I stop my recursion? Well, when I get down to groups of one, so each of you is individually sorted in order of height, you know, automatically. You can't do anything about that, okay? So when you get down to groups of one person, that's sorted. Now, that recursion comes back up and says, okay, now merge pairs of people into sorted order. So that gives me groups of two sorted. Now take each pair of groups of two, merge them, that gives you groups of four sorted. Now groups of four, merge, gives you groups of eight. So you double the sorting range every time. So you see that's going to be pretty fast to get to the entire n. And that's what merge sort is, okay, in a nutshell. Right? So here's the idea. Here's my input array. The lower half, of course, it may not be evenly split, but you split them as equal as possible. Okay? Lower half and upper half. They're not sorted already, but let's suppose we've done them. We've sorted them, so they're like that. Now you can see that merging those two is going to be fast. Okay? Well, how do we do the sorting? As I said, recursively apply the same idea. This does not end up in an infinite loop, of course, because the recursion, every time you call it, it's on a smaller and smaller data set, and you eventually get to the base of the recursion that says, well, if there's only one item there, you don't need to do any work, just return as is. Okay? And this method of problem solving is often called divide and conquer. Well, it always is, actually. Okay, it's divide and conquer is the idea. Okay, it won't always work. It can only work if the splitting of the problem is fast and then the piecing together of sub-solutions, in our case, lower half of the array and upper half of the array, is also fast. Okay. If it costs you too much to split the problem up or combine the sub-solutions, you've lost already. But in many situations, you can actually do the split up very quickly and the merging of subsolutions also very quickly, in which case you gain. So this isn't just a magic potion that always works. You'd have to think about, will this technique apply to my problem? Okay. All right? So here is our simple pseudocode for our merge sort algorithm. We're going to provide the array A and then a lower index and an upper index. So basically, merge Aij says, sort the array A from index I to index J. Okay. That allows us to focus on parts of the array without having to copy it, and therefore pay a price. Okay. So if I is less than J, you see, if I is equal to J or bigger than J, then there's either nothing in the array or there's just one item in the array, in which case you don't need to do anything. Okay. But if I is less than J, you've got at least two items in the array, so we need to split and sort recursively. So we find the midpoint, which is just I plus J over 2. We take the floor of that, which gives us a split of the array into as equal halves as you can possibly manage, okay, within one of each other. Okay. We call merge sort recursively with the array A an index from I to the midpoint. So that's the lower half. And then from the midpoint plus 1 to J, the upper half. Which of these two halves is the biggest if there's not an even number? Well, you work it out. The lower part is the biggest. Okay. It's the ceiling of n over 2, and the upper part is the floor of n over 2. Okay. I can't blame you if you haven't fully worked it out in your head. but work it out on a piece of paper. Simple thing to do using floors and ceilings. Okay. Remember, identity between floors and ceilings, which you should all have at your fingertips, the ceiling of n over 2 plus the floor of n over 2 is always equal to n, right? Okay. Simple little theorem to prove if you haven't seen it already. Yeah. Okay. So once you've worked out that the lower half, the size of the lower half of the array is equal to the ceiling of n over 2, you know that the upper half must be equal to the floor of n over 2. There can't be any choice. So you don't need to work out both halves. Just one half will do. Okay. How do you work out the lower half? Well, the size of the lower half is going to be, it goes from, my apologies, it goes from I to I plus j over 2, okay? So the size is this minus this plus 1, okay? And remember that n is j minus I plus 1. Okay. Now use those facts and deduce that therefore the size of the lower half of the array is precisely the ceiling of n over 2. Okay. A little bit of manipulation is required there, so a little challenge for you to do that. Okay. All right. So we do our two recursive calls. When they return, as they will, of course, because we keep reducing the size of array that, or the portion of the array that we're going to focus on, and when we get down to this condition failing, we return, so the recursion bottoms up, comes back up, okay? At each level of return, we merge the array sections which have been sorted. So when these two calls are finished, we have the array sorted from I to mid, and from mid plus 1 to j. And we have to glue those two portions together so it becomes sorted from I to j. And that's the function of this sub-procedure merge, okay, which we haven't quite described, although I did describe it in words. Okay. All right. What will our running time be for such a recursive algorithm? Well, when n is less than or equal to 1, of course, it's just constant time, theta 1. We just do the test and return. Okay. Otherwise, when n is 2 or more, we do the two splits, okay, of the array, and one of them has size ceiling of n over 2. This is why I was emphasizing this, that you need to do this little exercise. Okay. So if t of n is the cost of the algorithm, then on the recursive call, it costs t of the ceiling of n over 2 for the first call, and the second call costs t of the floor of n over 2. So that accounts for those two parts there, okay? We have to account for this computation here and then this here, okay? So let's defer that, call that T of merge, and we don't know how much that costs yet because we haven't given the algorithm yet, but it's on something of size n total, okay? The theta 1, of course, accounts for this test and this calculation here, okay? So a nice, simple recurrence there, okay? How do we perform the merging? Well, we've already basically seen that, okay? And here is a reminder. If our two portions are from here to just here for the lower portion and then from here to up here for the upper portion, and they've already been sorted by a recursive call, then we maintain an index to the first half, an index to the upper half, and just walk along both halves comparing pairwise. And we use an auxiliary array B into which we copy the sorted merged things. Clear? Okay. So I won't go through this in detail because I think it's pretty obvious. Okay. But notice we are using an extra array, so this is not going to be as attractive as some other algorithms, but nevertheless, let's just go with it, okay? Here is the pseudocode for the merge part, which looks horrendous, but it isn't really, okay? Let me just guide you through its portions, okay? It's really very simple. But actually, you've got to do it very carefully. It's very easy to make a mess of this. So although it's simple, it also can be quite thorny if you're not careful. Okay. So basically, this portion here is comparing the indices, you know, while you've still got stuff in the lower half and the upper half, you walk along, okay, and you compare, so k is the index in the lower half, l is the index in the upper half. You compare what's there, and you choose whichever is the smaller, and write it into your subarray B, and increment the appropriate index. If you use from the lower half, you increment k. If you use from the upper half, you increment l. Okay? So while there's anything in the lower half and upper half, you keep doing this. But of course, it may be that you exhaust one half and there's some stuff left in the other half. Right? Okay? So this loop here will only be executed if you, when you finish that section of comparing the stuff left in the lower half. Okay? You'll know that because k will end up being less than or equal to mid. Okay? If you used all the lower half, k will have been incremented one time, final time, and would have climbed above mid. So this won't be executed. Okay? So this only gets executed if, when you finish this main loop here, there was something left over in the lower half. Likewise, this will only be executed if when you finish this main business here, there was something left in the upper half. It can't be that there's something left in both, of course, right? Because you know, you keep comparing between halves until there's nothing left. Okay? So at most, one of these will be executed. Maybe neither, okay? Because it may be that both halves are exhausted when you finish. Okay? And then this final loop here is just to say, copy all the stuff in the array B back to the array A where you want to do your sorting. So it's not really a complicated bit of code. It looks horrendous, but you know, if you take it in portions, it's pretty simple, really. Okay. And quick quiz. Let's just see how you're following this. What's the status of merge sorts? Okay, so we've described it now fully in terms of the recursion and the merging. Is it stable and in place? Is it stable but not in place? Is it not stable but it is in place? Or neither stable or in place. Decide the answer for yourselves. Okay? It's just a little quick quiz. Okay? Well, one of them should be very obvious, and the other is maybe is not so obvious. Okay? It should be obvious that it's not in place because we use this auxiliary array B, right? So it's not in place. It is actually stable. If you look at the details, if you had equal keys, they won't get swapped around. But it's not entirely obvious. And it's quite subtle. If in the merge phase of line 6 we had a strictly less than instead of less than or equals, it would no longer be in place. Okay, so this kind of thing is quite subtle. Okay, but all the same, that's all I want to say about that. I'm not going to go into details because it's not the most important aspect of what we want to be doing. Okay. We're now in a position to write out the full recurrence for merge, so the full runtime. Because we know what merge now costs, it costs theta n, okay? Both in the best case and the worst case, because you always do travel along both arrays, both halves, and you've got to copy the entire thing back to the original array A, okay? So we can now write that merge sort is, the base case is theta 1, and then the recursive case is what we had before, plus the cost of merge plus theta 1, but that's theta n plus theta 1, and of course that's just theta n. So it boils down to this recurrence here, okay? Now, what's the solution to this recurrence? Well, before we start doing manipulations and all that, let's just use our brains a bit more creatively. Okay? What do you expect the solution of this to be? Well, let's just do a little bit of work on the board. Remember, the algorithm starts with an array of size n. Okay. And it calls, makes two recursive calls. Let's not worry about floors and ceilings. Just assume it's, you know, you can divide by two evenly. Okay, so you get two subcalls, two arrays of size n over two, n over two. Okay, let's just say it's the same size. Okay. Now, when these return, how much work do you do? Well, you did a constant amount of work to do this to calculate the midpoint. When these come back, you now do proportional to n amount of work to merge them. So the total amount of work you do up here is basically some constant times n. Okay. So this is the work done at this level. Okay. Now, what about this level? Well, the same reasoning applies. Here, you do a constant times n over 2 amount of work, and likewise here. So your total amount of work on this level is 2 times Cn over 2. And I won't insult you by asking you what this is. It's Cn, OK? I don't feel like insulting you today for some reason, OK? So I won't. I'll do it another time, OK? Don't worry. Yeah, I haven't lost my touch, OK? Well, of course, we haven't finished, because these incite further recursive calls, don't they? And
on each of these, the size of the array is half of what it was before, so it's n over 2 squared. Okay? And there are 2 squared calls. So the total cost is 2 squared times cn over 2 squared. And again, I don't feel like insulting you. It's cn, right? Now, you get the idea. At every level, the total amount of work you do at that level of recursion is just some constant times n, right? So, and when do we stop? Well, when we get down to size 1, or 0, but let's say 1, okay, yeah? So the question is, how many levels are there? Okay, so now, what's the depth here? Well, you go from n over 2, n over 2 squared, n over 2 cubed, n over blah, 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 blah. If there's depth d, then you're going to go to n over 2 to the d. And you stop when that is equal to 1, yeah? So solve this equation, and you've done it already. That means that d should be log n, right? Okay, so this depth here is log n. Yeah. All right, maybe floor and ceiling, but it doesn't, you're only trying to get the idea of the growth rate, so don't worry about plus or minus 1, all that nonsense, right? So what's the total amount of work done? Well, it's cn at every level. Number of levels is that many, so I won't insult you even there. Okay, you know, so I don't know why. I'll have to find some reason, but not yet. So cn log n is the total amount of work we do, yeah? And if that ain't the solution to our recurrence, there's something seriously wrong, right? Okay. This is basically a proof that the solution is that, okay? But let's go through and see how we might do it without the diagrams and so on, okay? So that's the solution. It really is that, okay? And one way we could verify this semi-intuitive argument, semi-formal, semi-intuitive, is the following. We could say, well, we know that when n is less than or equal to 1, it's a theta 1 cos. So let's call that C, okay? And then for the recursive case, you've got those two things plus some theta n function. Let's call that dn. You could object to that, by the way, because the theta n function, all we know about it is that it's bounded from above by some constant times n, and bounded from below by some possibly different constant times n. Okay, what we've done is say, well, let's just make those constants equal. Okay, if you wanted to be really, really picky, you say no. All you can write is q of n is less than or equal to some c1 and then some d1 n here, and it's bigger than or equal to some c2 and then some d2 times n there. But then you do the reasoning and you just get one, the same reasoning with the less than or equals, exactly the same reasoning with the bigger than or equals. You say, what the hell, make it equals, okay? Right. We're only trying to get an idea of the solution here, because even this argument is not a proof. It's going to give us an idea of what the solution ought to be, and if you were really picky, you'd then have to prove the solution correct, for example, by induction on n, okay? All right, let's carry on. And to make life simpler, let's assume that n is 2 to the k, so that there are no floors or ceilings involved anywhere. Now, this is reasonably okay, because essentially what we're doing is, if you think of your function t of n as a graph, we're taking samples of its values at 1, 2, 2 squared, 2 cubed, 2 to the fourth, and so on, getting an idea of its growth rate at those sample points, and then saying, well, it's going to be a reasonably smooth function, so if the growth rate is like that at those sample points, it's going to be the same at all other points as well. Okay. You could easily build a function which, for which this is false, but if it's a runtime of an algorithm, it won't be false, okay? And we can formally justify that, but let me not go into details now. Okay. So we're going to take a sample of the growth rate, basically. That's really what I did there, you know. If you think about it, okay? So we simplify our recurrence now to here, the floor and the ceiling become just n over 2. So that's just, oh, my apologies. So that just becomes 2tn over 2, okay? Now we can proceed to unwind what's called unwind the recurrence. So let me write on the board a version of the recurrence which you can keep referring to. Now, use a different variable name. So t of m is 2t of m over 2 plus d. And I hope, is that visible to everybody? Is that my writing not degenerated too far yet? Okay, right. All right, so we apply it for n, and we just get t of n is 2tn over 2 plus dn. But of course, we can now apply it for m equals n over 2. Okay, so we can take this middle term, this term here, and expand it.
Okay.
And so following that, what is replaced in the middle is this expression here. We can now expand the brackets, and we get that it's 2 squared t of n over 2 squared plus 2 dn. I don't want to expand the powers of 2 because we're going to see a pattern developing. Okay. Now we can apply the same recurrence with m equals n over 2 squared and plug in. Okay. This is so simple even a computer can do it. Again, we expand the bracket, keep the powers of 2, don't expand them because you want to see the pattern. Okay. And we get 2 cubed t of n over 2 cubed plus 3. Now, you don't need another step to see the pattern, do you? I mean, if you do, I think you may need to catch up in your sleep. You know? I mean, it's obvious, right? So, dot, dot, dot. So this is why it's not the formal proof. We're saying, oh, yeah, it's going to go like this, okay? But come on, okay. Amongst friends, let's not argue, okay? Right, so it's going to, if you do this for k steps, it's going to look like 2 to the k times t of n over 2 to the k plus k dn. If you want to be picky, you prove this by induction on k. Oh, come on, okay. Oh, life's too short. Okay, so if we put l equals log n, which is what I did at the top, just to save on notation, go for l steps, you get 2 to the l t of n over 2 to the l plus l dn. But of course, 2 to the l is just n by definition of l. Okay. 2 to the log n is n by definition of log. Okay. And n over 2 to the l becomes n over n, so that's just t of 1. Okay. So we get n times t of 1 plus l dn. L is, of course, log n. So we just get that this is equal to cn plus dn log n. And remember, c and d are positive constants, so this is a theta n log n function. Okay? Right, so that's another way of verifying this intuition here. Okay. Now, as I say, we've taken samples at powers of 2. If you look in the notes, there is a justification of why that's okay for this recurrence. Okay. But I'll leave you to read that in the notes if you have any doubts about it. Okay. All right. Let's compare the two algorithms now, merge sort versus insertion sort. Okay. Although the runtime of merge sort is, of course, asymptotically much, much faster. And let me remind you, we've already seen this many times. Powers of, well, log n compared to n. Okay, n is exponential in log n. Right. Remember, insertion sort runs in time theta n squared. Merge sort runs in time theta n log n. Don't underestimate. We haven't just made some marginal improvement. We've replaced one factor of n by log n. That is an absolutely huge improvement. It's unbelievably faster. Yeah, if you don't understand that, please revisit, you know, the graphs of n versus log n. It's a huge, huge improvement, not some minor little thing we've done. Even so, we don't necessarily dismiss insertion sort as an algorithm. Why? Because if, for example, the array is almost sorted, and you might imagine that you gather your data from various sources, and they've already kind of sorted their data, okay? So the array comes in almost sorted, so to speak, then insertion sort is actually going to run pretty much in linear time. It doesn't have to move too much stuff about. Okay? This is at the intuitive level. We could make this more precise, but let's not, you know, I don't want to spend time on that, okay? So if that happens to be the case for whatever reason, then insertion sort is going to be a better choice because, you see, merge sort will always do n log n cost anyway, no matter what the array looks like. It just goes through the whole thing, you know, blindly without worrying about what I've got there, okay? Even if the array is not sorted, for very small arrays, let's say, you know, if you've got an array of, let's say, 10 entries, you know, the cost of recursion and so on is going to just outweigh any savings you make. Insertions that we just zip through and, you know, take no time, right? So you have to be sensible, you know, about these things. Furthermore, insertion sort is in place, merge sort is not. Now that seems to count very heavily against merge sort, but we see that this feature of merge sort will be a big strength when we want to look at sorting so much data that it can't fit into main memory. If you apply this to, say, gathering data from the web and then wanting to sort that data, there's no computer that's going to fit all that data into main memory. And this feature of merge sort that we've looked at will then become an actually big, big strength over any other sorting algorithm. So we'll come back to that later on. So don't dismiss merge sort because of this feature. It will become a great strength later on, okay? Oh, before I move on, by the way, you already know of at least one other algorithm that was sorting time and log n. We didn't say it explicitly, okay? So another little challenge, seems to be the week of issuing challenges to you. Innovative learning week seems to be a good thing, okay? Use AVL trees to sort in time and log n. Very simple use of them gives you a sorting algorithm and log n time. Okay. All right. Let's now look at the general situation, okay, which I explained, I mentioned before. Okay. So the divide and conquer approach has this following templates. Okay. We're given a problem to solve on data of size n. Okay. We find some way of splitting the data into smaller problems. Let's say A, so problem P1, P2, up to PA for some A. In our case, A was 2. But in other applications, it may be something different. So some number of sub-problems, which will be be using smaller amounts of the data. Okay. Okay. So this is the setting up of the recursion, so to speak. Okay. Then we recursively solve the problem on these sub-problems, same technique, until we get down to small enough instances that we can solve them by some direct method. Okay. In our case, we got down to such small instances, size 1 arrays, that there was nothing to be done because size 1 arrays already are sorted. You don't need to do anything. But in other cases, you may need to do some little work when you get to some fixed constant size, which you determine. Okay. Because it's going to be a fixed constant size, the amount of work you do at that level is going to be a constant amount of work. Now, when these recursions come back to you, you take the solved subproblems and combine them into a solution of the original full-size problem. Okay. So your costs are the setting up cost, the recursion cost, and then the gluing together cost. And we can summarize that in a typical recurrence. If n is less than this critical value where the recursion stops, then you've got down to a constant size problem, you solve that directly in constant time, so that costs you a constant amount of time, so theta 1 time. When n is bigger than that critical size, you set up the recursion, you call it, etc., etc. So you're going to set up A problems of size, say n1, n2, up to na. You call the algorithm on those problems, so it costs you T of N1, T of N2, up to T of NA. And then you've got to account for the cost of setting up the recursion and the cost of gluing together the subresults, which we combine into one function, Fn, often called the driving function of the recurrence. So that's a fairly generic thing, which you can apply to any divide and conquer algorithm. So hint, in the exercise which you know that are all doing avidly, the practical. Yes, you are, aren't you? Oh, you've already done it. Okay. Yeah, of course. Right. I hope you're enjoying it, by the way. It's meant to be enjoyable. The algorithm is, of course, precisely a recursive algorithm. Okay. So the analysis of that algorithm is going to be done by this style. Okay. And it should be a fairly simple analysis. Okay. All right. Now, usually, the recurrences can be simplified. Typically, the size of these problems, they're all of equal size, not necessarily n over 2, but of some equal size. Okay, and then you can replace this more complicated expression by just A times T of n over B, where n over B is the size of the subproblems. Okay. Now, ignore all these conditions down here. They have to be there technically, but for any application, the runtime of algorithms, they're going to be satisfied. Okay? So I'm not going to worry about the conditions. they have to be there for legal reasons, but you know, amongst friends, we'll just say, yeah, okay,
right.
So don't get freaked out by them. They look like a whole set of complicated conditions. They're just the natural things you need for the thing to work, okay? And if you're applying it to runtime of algorithms, they're going to be satisfied, okay? All right, and again, with disregard flaws and ceilings, that seems like carelessness. It can actually be justified, okay?
All right, so we have recurrences of this kind, of this kind very often in analyzing algorithms of this kind, okay? And it would be a real pain if you have to solve them individually. Every time they come up, you've got to solve it. Ah, God, you know. Well, this is what theorems are for. They're labor-saving devices. You say, look, I keep doing this. It's always a similar pattern. Let me prove a theorem that applies in all cases. So I don't have to keep doing it, you know, so it's boring, okay? So the theorem here is called the Master Theorem. Now, I don't know why it's called the Master Theorem. It has hints of Doctor Who about it, if you're a fan of Doctor Who or something. I have no idea why it's called that. Anyway, that's what it's called, okay? And it just summarizes the situation for us beautifully, okay? So again, don't worry about all these conditions here. They will be satisfied for any runtime situation, okay? Technically, they have to be there because you could have a recurrence for which the conclusion is false because some of these conditions are freaked out, but that won't happen for our algorithms in terms of runtime, okay? So let's not worry about it. Okay, so if you've got a recurrence like this, okay, how do you solve it? Well, here's the beautiful thing about this, okay? We look at a critical number called the critical exponent, E, which is log to the base B of A. Now, you can remember that, why? Because B is below here, it's below there, A is above there, it's above there. So it's log to the base B of A, not log to the base A of B. An easy way to lose some marks in an exam, right? Okay? Yeah? Do remember it. And that's an easy mnemonic. It's the lower bit goes into the base of the log, the upper thing goes into the log, okay? We call this the critical exponent for the following simple reason. T of n is going to be theta of n to the e if k is less than e. K is the exponent of this driving function here. Okay. So you're looking at two exponents. One exponent and one critical number. Okay. The exponent of n here and this calculated number here. Okay. Comparing them. So if k is less than e, your solution is going to be this. You don't need to unwind the recurrence or do an induction or anything. It's going to be that. Just by comparing these two numbers. If they're equal, it's going to be theta of n to the e log n. Okay, no questions asked. Of course, that's the same as theta of n to the k log n, right? Because e equals k. Right? So you need to worry about which one there. Okay? If, on the other hand, there's only one more possibility left, k is bigger than e, your solution will be theta of n to the k. What that says, you see, is if k is bigger than this critical number, then the recursion bit contributes nothing to the growth rate. Okay. The cost is all in the driving function. Okay. And maybe that's the kind of thing that maybe your divide and conquer algorithm was a bit strange because, the recursion costs nothing. It's all in the setting up and the gluing together. So where did you save work? Okay. But nevertheless, it's a possibility. Okay, and that's it. That's all you have, okay? And so now, if you see a recurrence like this, you can solve it straight away by applying this simple comparison. Calculate your number E, compare it with K, and you've got three possibilities, end of. Now, I'm not going to prove this theorem in the course, not because it's terribly difficult, but because it would take quite a bit of setting up. If you want to see a proof, actually, of a slightly more general result, if you look in the CLRS book, that is one of the recommended texts if you want to look elsewhere, they have a proof of the result there. Okay. But we'll just take it on trust. Okay. And the theorem is still true. If you have a recurrence with flaws and ceilings, if you just ignore the flaws and ceilings to simplify it, we can formally justify that that's okay. You will get the correct result. And that's part of the proof of the theorem.
So if we had an expression like A1T of floor of N over B plus A2T of ceiling N over B, you can just ignore the floors and ceilings, and then your recurrence becomes A1 plus A2 times T of N over B. Okay, and that's, you know, as I say, can be formally justified as a technique. Okay. So it applies to the situation we had with the merge sort algorithm. So let's look at that. We had this recurrence for our merge sort. Well, what we've just observed says you can forget floors and ceilings, so that becomes just twice T of merge sort N over 2 plus theta of N. What's our critical exponent, E? Well, log to the base 2 of 2. Okay, so A is 2, B is 2, so E is log to the base B of A, log to the base 2 of 2, and again, I want to ask you what that is. It's obviously 1, by anybody's reckoning. Log to the base A of A is always 1, whatever A is, as long as A makes sense for logarithms, yeah? Okay, so in this case, E, you see K is 1, the exponent of N is 1 there, okay? So E equals K, so the middle case of the theorem applies, and the middle case says the runtime is theta of N to the E log N, but E is 1, so it's just theta of N log N. Okay, end of story. Saves a lot of work, doesn't it? I commend this to you. It's free. Free. And forever. You can't say better than that, can you? I was speaking to a student I'm supervising the other day, and I said, you send me this document, you know, and we'll go through it. And then I thought, I'd better tell him how to do it. I said, well, you're typesetting in LaTeX, won't you? And he looked at me, you've not heard of LaTeX? Best typesetting system in the world, free, forever. Oh. Look it up. It's available on all platforms. Yeah. You have to read the manual. Okay. But you will not get text typeset any better than that, even if you pay a small fortune to various corporations, which shall be nameless. Okay. Let's look at another example, okay, very quickly. Doesn't worry where this came from. It's just an example of the use of the theorem. Doesn't worry about, you know, what algorithm it corresponds to. None that I know of, by the way. It's purely an example. Well, here, what's our critical exponent? Log to the base B of A, so log to the base 2 of 7. Okay. Now, you don't get out your calculator, please. Now, remember, you only need to compare this to the exponent here, which is 4. So all you need to decide is whether log to the base 2 of 7 is less than 4, equal to 4, or bigger than 4. Well, hang on a minute. 2 cubed is what? Ah, thank you, yes. 8 is, compared to 7, is it bigger, equal, less than? Bigger. So 3 is too big to act as the log of 7, yeah? So log to the base 2 of 7 is less than 3. Well, 3 is less than 4. So log to the base 2 of 7 is less than 4. No calculator necessary. You save some batteries. Think about the Earth resources, people. I almost said that without a smile. Okay, yeah? So no need for calculators. It's, you know, it's pointless. Okay, so in our case, case 3 applies, right? Because K is bigger than E. So the runtime here is going to be theta of N to the 4th. The recursion contributes nothing to the growth rate. Of course, it contributes something to the noise, but not to the overall growth rate. It's all in the driving function. Okay? Well, brilliant. Okay. Further reading, of course, you know, you've got this entire week of uninterrupted study coming up, and you're all looking forward to, you know, sitting down with your books and your notes and so on. So you'll have plenty of time for further reading, and here's some suggestions which you might wish to consider should you run out of material to study. I'll see you week after next. I will miss you, but if you miss me, you're very sad people indeed. Okay, enjoy your week. See you next time.